Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. We were just speaking with Amy McDonald again. Her website is Brawley Arts, brawlyarts.org/Nepal, if you'd like to donate to that effort. Well, our next guest is the best-selling author of that book, you remember it, about raising kids in France or parenting. It was called Bringing Up Bebe. Now she's back with a hilarious and true midlife coming-of-age story. It's called There Are No Grown-Ups. It's in the same frank and funny voice, loved by those readers of her previous book. Best-selling author Pamela Druckerman explores friendships and relationships, careers, and the challenge of managing both young kids and old parents during this in-between decade. We welcome Pamela Druckerman to The Mountain Life. Great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I love this redefinition of midlife. So when is midlife, and has it shifted? And if so, why?
Well, 40 isn't even technically middle-aged anymore. Someone who's now 40 has a 50% chance of living to age 95. And people are having children later. The number of women having, the percentage of women having babies in their early 40s has doubled in the last 25 years. So yes, midlife has changed. And yet, turning 40 is still momentous to people. That hasn't changed. It's still symbolically freighted. And there are lots of changes that happen anyway, even though, you know, 40 has a different place in the lifespan. So it's a confusing age. And what I tried to do in this book was put my finger on it a little bit.
Okay. Part of putting your finger on it, which I love, is to find out that midlife crises are not, after all, so common as we thought they were. Why not?
It turns out that only about 10 to 20% of Americans have an event that will qualify as a midlife crisis. And of those people, the experts say that many of them are what they call crisis prone, which means they have crises throughout their lives. So they happen to have one when they're 42 as well. It turns out that the midlife crisis was a cultural idea that was kind of invented and named in the 1960s and 70s when there was all the social change, and the idea that you could transform your life, especially as a woman, was very appealing. And even when the scientists came along and said, actually, not everybody actually has this event, it's not biologically inevitable, the idea was so appealing to people, and it had such a great name, the midlife crisis, that it still stuck.
And there were so many great stereotypes around it, and I think it's funny because I sort of go towards men when I think of midlife crises and the red sports car. But women, I mean, are we at this point when we reach 40 that we can reinvent ourselves? And when we do, not labeling it as a crisis, but really embracing who we are in our 40s.
I think you're absolutely right. And what I found in my research that I did for this book was that while people didn't have crises, they often had this kind of reckoning. You know, turning 40 was this moment of, oh my God, this is my real life. I'm not practicing anymore. I'm not building up for some imagined, you know, future. This is it. It's now. And so people kind of had, a lot of people who I interviewed and who I know had this reckoning where they said, you know what, I don't want to do X job for the rest of my life, or I'm not really going to write that novel, or even, you know, I'm not really attracted to men. And, you know, they made major shifts in their life or in their careers or in their marriages that adjusted to who they felt they really are. And I saw in a lot of women a kind of very traumatic period in the early 40s, but then a kind of settling in the later 40s. And even if they didn't have the life that they had always thought they should have or they wanted to have, there was a kind of acceptance, and often very happily, with what they had actually achieved and who they were.
Yeah, well, it is sort of liberating to let go of those things as you reach this point in your life, those things that you thought were important, and one day you wake up and you go, you know, writing that book is not really what I want to do. And instead, there's something new, and it's usually an evolution from what we held as being one of our needs or a bucket list priorities. And it just evolves, and that is really liberating.
I totally agree, and I saw that in so many people I spoke to. And there are these really crucial psychological shifts that happen in midlife. And one of them is that people become, for lack of a better word, less neurotic, which means they're less concerned about what other people think. They have less of a kind of worrying dialogue in their head saying, what do people, you know, what does everyone think? Do they like me? And they can just live a little bit more and see how they're similar to other people. I think in earlier years we focus on feeling different and how we're unique. And kind of in midlife you start to realize that really you have more in common with other people than you thought. Yeah. And that's very relaxing.
Yes, absolutely. So it seems as though you've made the point that at some point in your life, we all become a little more comfortable with our preferences and our choices, who we are going to spend our valuable time with and who we are going to eliminate from that space of time.
I agree. I mean, one thing that I say in the book is in your 40s and beyond, you can now spot narcissists before they ruin your life. You're kind of, because you don't have this neurotic chatter in your head of worry about what other people think, you become better at judging others and understanding what their qualities are, what's good about them and what's bad about them. And so you become better at filtering out friends. So I realized in my 40s that I have two key criteria for friends. One is that they have a sense of humor, and the other is that they're nice. And without those two, it's no deal.
It's so funny because I did not know what a narcissist even was until my 40s. And so funny that you even bring up
lucky
that
you.
Word. I know. And then I had to, you know, figure it out and go through this definition and say, oh, okay, yeah, I don't want that person in my life.
So following up on Lynn's comment, I'm curious as to why you chose to write this book right now, and I'm making the assumption that it has something to do with the phase of life that you're in. I'm guessing you're something around 40 years old or so.
I'm a bit further on in my 40s now because I spent a good part of my 40s working on this book. But yeah, I think it was when I was sitting at a dinner with a bunch of friends my age, and I realized everyone at the table now had a sport that they were not, their doctor had told them they're no longer allowed to play. And I also realized, like, I was old enough to sue for age discrimination at 40. You know, there were all these, I walked into a drugstore, and I was looking at the face creams, and the saleswoman kind of gently steered me toward the anti-aging creams. And I thought, this is so weird. It was just a month ago that I was, you know, a young mother, a young woman, and now I have to put on the anti-aging cream. What is going on? It seemed like this, the sum of all these really small changes were kind of adding up.
Yeah. You know, when now you talk to people in their mid-30s or their early 30s, there is this daunting, ominous presence of, oh, turning 40. What advice would you give them? Because as it turns out, and I have to disclose to you that I'm now in the next decade, the 50s, which it's just been the best time of my life. And so if I could go back, or, you know, if I could tell those in their mid-30s something, what's that wisdom?
I mean, one of the great things about being a little bit older is you know how to disappoint people. You know how to say no. It's such a busy time of life. You have, you know, your kind of work is going gangbusters. Often it's the busiest time in work. It's the busiest time in child rearing. Your parents are getting older, and you just don't have time anymore for anything. And so you learn how to kind of, and you're better at predicting what things are going to be like. You kind of know, you know what, I'm not really going to like that concert, or I'm not really that kind of person. So you can say no to the things you don't want to do and yes to the things you do want to do. And so life becomes, it's a very busy time, but you become a little more ruthless, I would say. You don't have lunch with the people you don't want to have lunch with anymore. But you enjoy your life much more. And I'm very happy to hear this about the 50s. And I have to say that I've heard from a number of men and women in their 50s that the best is yet to come.
Oh, absolutely. And yet there are these physical things that we just, you know, we just can't get around. And one of those, as women, is menopause, perimenopause. And this is something that, I don't know, it's sort of taking it in this positive way. This is coming. We can't avoid it. How do we best mitigate its effects, I guess?
Well, one thing that I studied in this book was the sexuality of older women and the sexual behavior of older women, because I noticed in the statistics that post-menopause sexual activity among American women drops off markedly from the 40s. The 40s is still pretty good. In the 50s, it kind of starts to fall off a cliff. And I wondered, is this just inevitable? Is that part of menopause? And it turns out that it's more of a cultural story than a biological story, and that in some cultures, sexual behavior continues quite strongly among women into the 50s and even 60s and beyond. So I think it's really important to know that this is not an inevitable decline, and that just because your fertility wanes, it doesn't mean sexual behavior or sexual desire needs to wane. It might be that you need a little help in some areas, as men do as well, but it's not. We need to differentiate these two factors, the cultural factors and the biological factors.
Okay, you've piqued my curiosity. What exactly is it those French women do?
It's funny you should mention France, because I live in Paris, and in France, sexual behavior, sexual activity among women does not, it starts to gently decline in the 50s, but it's by no means the kind of falling off the cliff that we have in America. And it's because they have this belief, this story in the culture that all humans, even those of us who are not kind of firm and cellulite free and 25, deserve to have sex. It's just something that all healthy adults do throughout their lives. It's not kind of reserved for the young and perfect. And so having that in the culture and having role models of, you know, all these, older French actresses who play these quite sexualized roles in films and TV, it helps create a different story about how life goes. And I interviewed a lot of older French women for this book, and I was just amazed by the stories they told me about their lives and the kinds of things they do sort of on the side.
I can't help but say that in my experience, when I've traveled around the world, I have noticed on many beaches that there is a lot less concern, or maybe I would call it body shaming, that goes along in European areas or European countries, and it's not just Europe, it's actually down in the Caribbean as well, but they all tend to have a European influence to them. And I've noticed many people later on in life who have no problem exhibiting more of their body, wearing bikinis, wearing smaller bathing suits, and just being out enjoying the sun and the beach in a way that you don't generally see in the United States.
Uh-huh. Well, there's this idea in America, certainly in the sort of middle classes and upper middle classes, that you should try to look as young as you can for as long as you can, that you're kind of in this battle to fight time. And if you're going to lose the battle eventually. It's inevitable. And then there's kind of shame and disappointment when you've lost the battle. You sort of blame yourself. And maybe you go off and say, you know, I don't care what anyone thinks at all anymore, and which is not very neither true nor desirable, I don't think. And the French have a different story, which is that you should try to look like the best version of the age that you are. And lots of women who I interviewed said they try to feel happy in their own age, that is the aspiration. And, you know, they don't all achieve that, nor do they all say that, but it's kind of in the air here in a way that it isn't in America. And I think it's very calming to feel like, You can be the best. You know, you don't have to strive to look 35 for the rest of your life, even when you're 55, because it just doesn't work. And you end up looking not better, but unhappy, I think.
Yes, even worse. Yes. One of my friends said to me the other day, as all good friends ought to, I think I was lamenting about my wrinkles, and they said, it's your wrinkles that make you beautiful. Can't I just kind of go through my day believing that? And I'm going to work on it. I'm going to start working on believing that.
I don't know that I wouldn't say it's the wrinkles that make you beautiful. It's who you are that makes you beautiful.
Yes.
And if you embrace who you are, if you accept that it's your specificity, it's your combination of flaws and good qualities that create this creature who is you and who's unique and who's appealing, then you can kind of detach a little bit from that fear of aging and fear of time and wrinkles that makes people, I think, less attractive.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if you're familiar with Park City, Utah, where we live, but it's a, you know, a mountain town and we're all quite active. And one thing I notice about, you know, sort of getting to that midlife is has to do with when you go camping. And, you know, forever we would have these Insulite pads that we'd sleep on that were never very comfortable, no matter how great they were or how much we paid for the Insulite pad when camping. A sure sign I've seen is, you know, you upgrade to a trailer or you upgrade to a cot or, you know, you're no longer tent camping. That's kind of how we identify. Some of us are, but it's, you know, it's kind of, you know, you reach this point where it's okay to have a lot more comfortable way of camping. That's our signal.
I have a kind of urban equivalent of that, which is that I'm no longer willing to sleep on anyone's couch. If they say, sure, you can stay with me, you'll sleep on the couch, I say, you know what, I think I'm going to get a hotel room.
I like that. I like that. I love what you say about when you watch The Graduate, and as we all probably have as adults, you start to identify with the parents instead of with Dustin Hoffman.
But it's really, it's not all negative about being middle-aged. As you said, you know, there are just wonderful parts of it, and so much of it has to do with being more relaxed with other people. And, you know, I write in the book about going to my various college reunions, and there was one in my 20s and one in my 30s, and people were kind of competitive and distant and worried about their status. And by our reunion in our 40s, everyone just wanted to enjoy each other's company and have a great time. It was just a real relief.
Absolutely. And what about, you know, mingling with younger people? I've noticed I have some friends in their early 30s, and I've really valued the relationship between between folks, you know, in my age range and younger people, and even those of my kids' age in their early 20s. It seems like you get to this point where people are ageless, you know, no matter how young they are. We're just at different points in our lives, and we're all sort of just in this together as humanity in general. And that also feels really good to me.
I think that's a really good insight, and it's true. I realize I have friends in their 80s now, friends in their 70s. Friends in their 20s, I really don't care anymore. I'm just more focused on the person. I think you're right.
Yeah. Well, how much fun did you have writing this book?
Have you ever written a book?
No.
It's not fun to write. I mean, it's fun to take notes, but the actual work of writing a book is agony. But hopefully the result is fun to read.
And contrasting this book, There Are No Grown-Ups, a midlife coming-of-age story, with your last book, Bringing Up Bebe, One American Mother Discovers the Wisdom of French Parenting. Two very different books, but probably an exploration of two different times that you were looking at in your life. How do you see the juxtaposition of both of these books that you've written?
They're similar books in a way, because both are a combination of memoir and of reporting and of looking at the scientific research to kind of ground what I'm saying in the data and hard data and science. I didn't feel in this book that I in Bringing Up Bebe, I wrote mostly about my children and what it was like raising them when they were really young. In this book, I really write more about myself, you know, what it's like as a woman, as a person, kind of entering middle age, and it's a reported book, but it's also a deeply personal book. And when I was on a book tour recently in America, this woman came up to me after my talk, and she said, "Pamela, thank you for opening your kimono to us." And I thought, oh, no, please, I've got to close the kimono. And I still open the book sometimes, and I think, did I really write that? Did I publish that? But it's out there. I guess every memoirist feels that way.
It is. And so symbolic. I mean, going from writing a book about being a parent and that decade or those years that we really focus on being parents and we focus on our kids. And now it's okay to focus a little bit more on yourself. And thus this wonderful book, There Are No Grown-Ups, A Midlife Coming-of-Age Story. Pamela Druckerman, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. Great to talk to you.
Lynn, thank you so much for having me on. I wish I was in the mountains right now.
Well, I wish I was in Paris right now, actually. So
you can sleep on my couch if you come.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Pamela.